infection without fear of being contaminated. It is better, if possible, to have a proofreader's job. Comme ça, tout s'arrange. That means that if you happen to be strolling home at 3 in the morning and you are intercepted by the bicycle cops, you can snap your fingers at them. In the morning when the market is in swing, you can buy Belgian eggs at 50 centimes apiece. A proofreader doesn't get up usually until noon, or a little after. It's well to choose a hotel near a cinema, because if you have a tendency to oversleep, the bells will wake you up in time for the matinee. Or if you can't find a hotel near a cinema, choose one near a cemetery. It comes to the same thing. Above all, never despair. Il ne faut jamais désespérer. Which is what I try to din into Carl and Van Norden every night. A world without hope, but no despair. It's as though I had been converted to a new religion, as though I were making an annual novena every night to Our Lady of Solace. I can't imagine what there would be to gain if I were made editor of the paper, or even president of the United States. I'm up a blind alley, and it's cozy and comfortable. With a piece of copy in my hand, I listen to the music around me, the hum and drone of voices, the tinkle of the linotype machines, as if there were 1,000 silver bracelets passing through a ringer. Now and then a rat scurries past our feet, or a cockroach descends the wall in front of us, moving nimbly and gingerly on his delicate legs. The events of the day are slid under your nose quietly, unostentatiously, with now and then a byline to mark the presence of a human hand, an ego, a touch of vanity. The procession passes serenely, like a cortege entering the cemetery gates. The paper under the copy desk is so thick that it almost feels like a carpet with a soft nap. Under Van Norden's desk, it is stained with brown juice. Around 11 o'clock, the peanut vendor arrives, a half-wit of an Armenian who is also content with his lot in life. Now and then I get a cablegram from Mona saying that she's arriving on the next boat. Letter following, it always says. It's been going on like this for 9 months, but I never see her name in the list of boat arrivals, nor does the garçon ever bring me a letter on a silver platter. I haven't any more expectations in that direction either. If she ever does arrive, she can look for me downstairs, just behind the lavatory. She'll probably tell me right away that it's unsanitary. That's the first thing that strikes an American woman about Europe, that it's unsanitary. Impossible for them to conceive of a paradise without modern plumbing. If they find a bedbug, they want to write a letter immediately to the Chamber of Commerce. How am I ever going to explain to her that I'm contented here? She'll say I've become a degenerate. I know her line from beginning to end. She'll want to look for a studio with a garden attached, and a bathtub, to be sure. She wants to be poor in a romantic way. I know her. But I'm prepared for her this time. There are days, nevertheless, when the sun is out and I get off the beaten path and think about her hungrily. Now and then, despite my grim satisfaction, I get to thinking about another way of life, get to wondering if it would make a difference having a young, restless creature by my side. The trouble is, I can hardly remember what she looks like, nor even how it feels to have my arms around her. Everything that belongs to the past seems to have fallen into the sea. I have memories, but the images have lost their vividness. They seem dead and desultory, like time-bitten mummies stuck in a quagmire. If I try to recall my life in New York, I get a few splintered fragments, nightmarish and covered with verdigris. It seems as if my own proper existence had come to an end somewhere. Just where exactly, I can't make out. I'm not an American anymore, nor a New Yorker, and even less a European or a Parisian. I haven't any allegiance, any responsibilities, any hatreds, any worries, any prejudices, any passion. I'm neither for nor against. I'm a neutral. When we walk home of a night, the three of us, it often happens after the first spasms of disgust that we get to talking about the condition of things with that enthusiasm which only those who bear no active part in life can muster. What seems strange to me sometimes when I crawl into bed is that all this enthusiasm is engendered just to kill time, just to annihilate the 3/4 of an hour which it requires to walk from the office to Montparnasse. We might have the most brilliant, the most feasible ideas for the amelioration of this or that, but there is no vehicle to hitch them to. And what is more strange, is that the absence of any relationship between ideas and living causes us no anguish, no discomfort. We have become so adjusted that if tomorrow we were ordered to walk on our hands, we would do so without the slightest protest. Provided, of course, that the paper came out as usual and that we touched our pay regularly. Otherwise, nothing matters. Nothing. We have become orientalized. We have become coolies, white-collar coolies, silenced by a handful of rice each day. A special feature in American skulls, I was reading the other day, is the presence of the epactyl bone, or os inci, in the occiput. The presence of this bone, so the savant went on to say, is due to a persistence of the transverse occipital suture, which is usually closed in fetal life. Hence it is a sign of arrested development and indicative of an inferior race. The average cubical capacity of the American skull, so he went on to say, falls below that of the white and rises above that of the black race. Taking both sexes, the Parisians of today have a cranial capacity of 1,448 cubic centimeters, the Negroes 1,344 centimeters, the American Indians 1,376. From all of which I deduce nothing, because I am an American and not an Indian. But it's cute to explain things that way, by a bone, an os inci, for example. It doesn't disturb his theory at all to admit that single examples of Indian skulls have yielded the extraordinary capacity of 1,920 cubic centimeters, a cranial capacity not exceeded in any other race. What I note with satisfaction is that the Parisians of both sexes seem to have a normal cranial capacity. The transverse occipital suture is evidently not so persistent with them. They know how to enjoy an aperitif, and they don't worry if the houses are unpainted. There's nothing extraordinary about their skulls, so far as cranial indices go. There must be some other explanation for the art of living, which they have brought to such a degree of perfection. At Monsieur Paul's, the bistro across the way, there is a back room reserved for the newspaper men, where we can eat on credit. It is a pleasant little room with sawdust on the floor and flies in season and out. When I say that it is reserved for the newspaper men, I don't mean to imply that we eat in privacy. On the contrary, it means that we have the privilege of associating with the whores and pimps who form the more substantial element of Monsieur Paul's clientele. The arrangement suits the guys upstairs to a T, because they're always on the lookout for tail, and even those who have a steady little French girl are not averse to making a switch now and then. The principal thing is not to get a dose. At times it would seem as if an epidemic had swept the office, or perhaps it might be explained by the fact that they all sleep with the same woman. Anyhow, it's gratifying to observe how miserable they can look when they are obliged to sit beside a pimp who, despite the little hardships of his profession, lives a life of luxury by comparison. I'm thinking particularly now of one tall, blonde fellow who delivers the Havas messages by bicycle. He is always a little late for his meal, always perspiring profusely and his face covered with grime. He has a fine, awkward way of strolling in, saluting everybody with two fingers and making a beeline for the sink, which is just between the toilet and the kitchen. As he wipes his face, he gives the edibles a quick inspection. If he sees a nice steak lying on the slab, he picks it up and sniffs it, or he will dip the ladle into the big pot and try a mouthful of soup. He's like a fine bloodhound, his nose to the ground all the time. The preliminaries over, having made pee-pee and blown his nose vigorously, he walks nonchalantly over to his wench and gives her a big, smacking kiss, together with an affectionate pat on the rump. Her, the wench, I've never seen look anything but immaculate, even at 3 a.m., after an evening's work. She looks exactly as if she had just stepped out of a Turkish bath. It's a pleasure to look at such healthy brutes, to see such repose, such affection, such appetite as they display. It's the evening meal I'm speaking of now, the little snack that she takes before entering upon her duties. In a little while she will be obliged to take leave of her big blonde brute, to flop somewhere on the boulevard and sip her digestif. If the job is irksome or wearing or exhaustive, she certainly doesn't show it. When the big fellow arrives, hungry as a wolf, she puts her arms around him and kisses him hungrily, his eyes, nose, cheeks, hair, the back of his neck. She'd kiss his ass if it could be done publicly. She's grateful to him, that's evident. She's no wage slave. All through the meal, she laughs convulsively. You wouldn't think she had a care in the world, and now and then, by way of affection, she gives him a resounding slap in the face, such a whack as would knock a proofreader spinning. They don't seem to be aware of anything but themselves and the food that they pack away in shovelsful. Such perfect contentment, such harmony, such mutual understanding, it drives Van Norden crazy to watch them. Especially when she slips her hand in the big fellow's fly and caresses it, to which he generally responds by grabbing her tit and squeezing it playfully. There is another couple who arrive usually about the same time, and they behave just like two married people. They have their spats, they wash their linen in public, and after they've made things disagreeable for themselves and everybody else, after threats and curses and reproaches and recriminations, they make up for it by billing and cooing, just like a pair of turtle doves. Lucien, as he calls her, is a heavy platinum blonde with a cruel, saturnine air. She has a full underlip, which she chews venomously when her temper runs away with her, and a cold, beady eye, a sort of faded china blue, which makes him sweat when she fixes him with it. But she's a good sort, Lucien, despite the condor-like profile which she presents to us when the squabbling begins. Her bag is always full of dough, and if she deals it out cautiously, it is only because she doesn't want to encourage him in his bad habits. He has a weak character. That is, if one takes Lucien's tirades seriously. He will spend 50 francs of an evening while waiting for her to get through. When the waitress comes to take his order, he has no appetite.
Ah, you're not hungry again, growls Lucien.
Humph! You were waiting for me, I suppose, on the Faubourg Montmartre. You had a good time, I hope, while I slaved for you. Speak, imbecile! Where were you? When she flares up like that, when she gets enraged, he looks up at her timidly, and then, as if he had decided that silence was the best course, he lets his head drop, and he fiddles with his napkin. But this little gesture, which she knows so well, and which of course is secretly pleasing to her, because she is convinced now that he is guilty, only increases Lucien's anger.
"Speak, imbecile!"
she shrieks. And with a squeaky, timid little voice, he explains to her woefully that while waiting for her, he got so hungry that he was obliged to stop off for a sandwich and a glass of beer. It was just enough to ruin his appetite. He says it dolefully, though it's apparent that food just now is the least of his worries. "But," and he tries to make his voice sound more convincing, "I was waiting for you all the time," he blurts out.
"Liar!" she screams. "Liar!
Ah, fortunately, I too am a liar. A good liar. You make me ill with your petty little lies. Why don't you tell me a big lie?" He hangs his head again, and absent-mindedly he gathers a few crumbs and puts them to his mouth, whereupon she slaps his hand.
"Don't do that! You make me tired. You're such an imbecile. Liar!"
"Just you wait. I have more to say. I am a liar too, but I am not an imbecile." In a little while, however, they are sitting close together, their hands locked, and she is murmuring softly, "Ah, my little rabbit, it is hard to leave you now. Come here, kiss me. What are you going to do this evening? Tell me the truth, my little one. I am sorry that I have such an ugly temper." He kisses her timidly, just like a little bunny with long pink ears, gives her a little peck on the lips, as if he were nibbling a cabbage leaf, and at the same time his bright round eyes fall caressingly on her purse, which is lying open beside her on the bench. He is only waiting for the moment when he can graciously give her the slip. He is itching to get away, to sit down in some quiet café on the Rue de Faubourg Montmartre. I know him, the innocent little devil, with his round, frightened eyes of a rabbit, and I know what a devil's street is the Faubourg Montmartre, with its brass plates and rubber goods, the lights twinkling all night, and sex running through the street like a sewer. To walk from the Rue Lafayette to the boulevard is like running the gauntlet. They attach themselves to you like barnacles. They eat into you like ants. They coax, wheedle, cajole, implore, beseech. They try it out in German, English, Spanish. They show you their torn hearts and their busted shoes. And long after you've chopped the tentacles away, long after the fizz and sizzle has died out, the fragrance of the lavabo clings to your nostrils. It is the odor of the parfum de danse, whose effectiveness is guaranteed only for a distance of 20 centimeters. One could piss away a whole lifetime in that little stretch between the boulevard and the Rue Lafayette. Every bar is alive, throbbing, the dice loaded. The cashiers are perched like vultures on their high stools, and the money they handle has a human stink to it. There is no equivalent in the Banque de France for the blood money that passes currency here, the money that glistens with human sweat, that passes like a forest fire from hand to hand and leaves behind it a smoke and stench. A man who can walk through the Faubourg Montmartre at night without panting or sweating, without a prayer or a curse on his lips, a man like that has no balls, and if he has, then he ought to be castrated. Supposing the timid little rabbit does spend 50 francs of an evening while waiting for his Lucienne. Supposing he does get hungry and buy a sandwich and a glass of beer, or stop and chat with somebody else's trollop. You think he ought to be weary of that round, night after night? You think it ought to weigh on him, oppress him, bore him to death? You don't think that a pimp is inhuman, I hope. A pimp has his private grief and misery, too. Don't you forget. Perhaps he would like nothing better than to stand on the corner every night with a pair of white dogs and watch them piddle. Perhaps he would like it if, when he opened the door, he would see her there reading the Paris Soir, her eyes already a little heavy with sleep. Perhaps it isn't so wonderful, when he bends over his Lucienne, to taste another man's breath. Better maybe to have only 3 francs in your pocket and a pair of white dogs that piddle on the corner than to taste those bruised lips. Bet you when she squeezes him tight, when she begs for that little package of love which only he knows how to deliver, bet you he fights like 1,000 devils to pump it up, to wipe out that regiment that has marched between her legs. Maybe when he takes her body and practices a new tune, maybe it isn't all passion and curiosity with him, but a fight in the dark, a fight single-handed against the army that rushed the gates, the army that walked over her, trampled her, that left her with such a devouring hunger that not even a Rudolph Valentino could appease. When I listen to the reproaches that are leveled against a girl like Lucienne, when I hear her being denigrated or despised because she is cold and mercenary, because she is too mechanical, or because she's in too great a hurry, or because this or because that, I say to myself, hold on there, bozo, not so fast. Remember that you're far back in the procession. Remember that a whole army corps has laid siege to her, that she's been laid waste, plundered, and pillaged. I say to myself, listen, bozo, don't begrudge the 50 francs you hand her because you know her pimp is pissing it away in the Faubourg Montmartre. It's her money, and her pimp. It's blood money. It's money that'll never be taken out of circulation because there's nothing in the Banque de France to redeem it with. That's how I think about it often, when I'm seated in my little niche, juggling the Havas reports or untangling the cables from Chicago, London, and Montreal. In between the rubber and silk markets and the Winnipeg grains, there oozes a little of the fizz and sizzle of the Faubourg Montmartre. When the bonds go weak and spongy, and the pivotals balk, and the volatiles effervesce, when the grain market slips and slides, and the bulls commence to roar, when every fucking calamity, every ad, every sport item and fashion article, every boat arrival, every travelogue, every tag of gossip has been punctuated, checked, revised, pegged, and rung through the silver bracelets, when I hear the front page being hammered into whack, and see the frogs dancing around like drunken squibs, I think of Lucienne, sailing down the boulevard with her wings outstretched, a huge silver condor suspended over the sluggish tide of traffic, a strange bird from the tips of the Andes with a rose-white belly and a tenacious little knob. Sometimes I walk home alone, and I follow her through the dark streets, follow her through the court of the Louvre, over the Pont des Arts, through the arcade, through the fence and slits, the somnolence, the drugged whiteness, the grill of the Luxembourg, the tangled boughs, the snores and groans, the green slats, the strum and tinkle, the points of the stars, the spangles, the jetties, the blue and white striped awnings that she brushed with the tips of her wings. In the blue of an electric dawn, the peanut shells look wan and crumpled. Along the beach at Montparnasse, the water lilies bend and break. When the tide is on the ebb and only a few syphilitic mermaids are left stranded in the muck, the dome looks like a shooting gallery that's been struck by a cyclone. Everything is slowly dribbling back to the sewer. For about an hour, there is a death-like calm during which the vomit is mopped up. Suddenly, the trees begin to screech from one end of the boulevard to the other.